Or like they're not. So. Oh fuck! Sorry. What is this?
I don't know. What are you doing? What is what?
Did you guys hear that?
No. Oh,
there was a sound that played.
Sarah
on my
has
computer.
A ghost.
I went into a. I was just, you know, searching Claire Danes on Twitter, as you do, and I clicked on an article in InStyle that was the highest paid actors on TV, and she's listed on it.
Of course she is. I think she's up to half a million.
Yeah, $450,000. Yeah. Shit. She gets paid more than The Rock per episode.
What does it say?
$450,000 per episode.
Yeah, I've always, because about
Wait,
three...
Wait, she gets paid more than The Rock doing what?
More than The Rock on his HBO show.
The Rock is on an HBO show?
My fault, and in a way I guess it was. I'm just now finding out what it was all about. We moved to the West Coast, away from everyone. She never told me that you called. Back when I was still still in love, till I opened my eyes and walked out the door, and the clouds came tumbling down, and it's bye-bye, goodbye, I tried, and I twisted it wrong just to make it right, had to leave myself behind, and I've been flying high all night, so come pick me up, I've landed.
All right, we are talking about episode 9, which was titled Sock Puppets, which I thought would be a reference to Franny, but actually turned about to be a reference to a massive propaganda machine. So there's that. Yeah, what did you guys...
Isn't there like a real meaning for sock puppets? Like, yeah. What is it, Ashley? Didn't you tell me that?
Yeah, we have this whole conversation, and I'm actually looking at our conversation on Twitter, Sarah, from the day I told you that it was called Sock Puppets, to see if I told you correctly.
I think I just saw the title and was like, another fucking title like that.
So Sock Puppets is essentially, it's a blanket term for sort of fake accounts that you use to follow other people.
Yeah.
So it was a literal reference to what it actually is then. Huh.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. That's not always the case with their episode titles.
I found it kind of ironic as I was watching, because my investment in the show is so tied to the internet and sometimes trolls on the internet. I just found it weird to be watching these scenes where they were talking about people who literally their sole job in life is to make up fake lives and post fake shit on the internet. And I was like, this is it was too weird, because there's been so many times where I'm just like, they're like, the person who's sending this in cannot be a real person. Like, there's no way. I just found it weird. But
it was a little, I don't know if the word's meta, but it was a little, well, also because I felt like I think there was moments in this episode where you could almost argue he was, and I don't think Gonza does this very often, but he was referring so directly to some of the things we struggle with as fans of the show that it felt like it was a little bit talking to us. And so at the same time, he was talking about internet stuff, and I did have my own moments too where I was like, this is a little weird.
Yeah, anyway. So let's get right into that, because I think you're right. There were times throughout this episode where it did feel like they were addressing the audience directly. in ways that were either uncomfortable or humorous or whatever. But I think the first example of that is the first scene in the episode, which is the Carrie and court mandated therapy scene, which Carrie in therapy is something that I've been like,
I'm glad somebody's mandating it for her.
This episode did make me realize that Carrie needs to be in therapy long term, because girlfriend has a lot of shit to work through. Like, it is bonkers that she is not in therapy. Like, what the hell? If there's ever been a person who's like existed who needs therapy more than this woman, I don't know who that is, except for maybe Quinn. Like, Quinn also needs some like therapy. Yeah, he needs some like analysis. But Carrie, it was just so, it's so crazy to see her in therapy, because I've never been to therapy before, but even in like 2 minutes of that scene, which is like 2 minutes of what she said was a 90-minute like appointment, like they were talking about like deep and like emotional shit, and I imagine that's what the entire time was, and it was just crazy to me. But I've been pining for a Carrie in therapy scene for like years and years and years, because I've just thought like it would have to be very kind of rich, dramatic ground. And I loved the scene, and I loved what they addressed. And I did feel at times that it was her addressing the audience, but I loved that scene. And I was like, for them to start with that, I was like sitting on my couch, like almost screaming into a pillow, because it was so excruciating for me to watch. I'm not, that's not an exaggeration, but that's,
I know, we've watched the show with you.
That was my reaction, was like, what the fuck? This cannot be happening right now. It was just, they went totally there the entire time. And I was really surprised. I was surprised at the words they let her say about Brody.
Meanwhile, I was surprised at the words they let her say about Quinn.
Really? It was like a rehash of what she said in episode 7 to the CPS.
Well, I thought it was fascinating that let her talk about both of them in one fell swoop.
It was fascinating that she literally like drew the line from one to the other directly. Like, that was a moment. Yeah,
it was a moment. It felt it's so funny that the critical response to this episode hasn't been all that favorable, because I don't know, critics don't like it very often when I'm looking at Judith Warner's review right now. They don't like it when there's a lot of exposition and kind of hat tipping around issues that we've all been waiting for a little bit of explanation around. But as fans, I thought it was kind of fantastic, because we needed some of the gray spaces of the show to be filled in a little bit. I mean, there's been a lot of issues, everything from her struggle with motherhood to how she feels about Brody and how she sort of thinks about the two men together, and guilt and love and crazy stuff with her relationship with Saul, which was just so excellent in this episode. I don't know. Like, I just felt like it was a needed episode to kind of, I felt like it was just setting up the next 3 episodes for what's probably going to be a ton of action. But I thought it was great. That was really great.
So, like, what do you guys think about them including Brody and Quinn in the same conversation for Carrie? Like, does that, as people who love Quinn and want to see them get together, did that make you uncomfortable considering your feelings about Carrie Brody, or just how the Carrie Brody relationship?
I loved the Carrie Brody relationship. I love Brody.
Maybe this is a question for Cynthia then. not to cut you off or anything, but I thought that it would be uncomfortable for major Carey Quinn people. Maybe not you guys though, but just to see her talk about them in similar ways, considering the dramatic conclusion that we saw with Brody. And the ways in which as a fandom and like overall in the narrative, we generally think that the Carey Brody relationship was incredibly misguided and at times delusional.
Well, it was misguided and delusional. Okay, words. But that doesn't negate her feelings for him. She still had Franny.
No, I know, but
so however we might feel about Brody, it doesn't really change how Carey felt about him. She had not a great perspective on it at the time, and I don't think she'll ever have a full perspective on it, but no, I don't think there's anything wrong with the way they address that.
I'm not saying there's anything wrong. I guess what I mean is, as an audience, we often talk about the Carey Brody relationship as misguided and at many points delusional. Like, we would agree that that's a fair assessment of how the viewership talks about that relationship, right?
And, well, because realistically, that's what it was.
Yes, right, because that's what it was. And Carrie's kind of code word for that was, we had a very intense relationship. It's like her euphemism for all of the crazy shit that went on between them. And then, you know, 30 seconds later, she starts to talk about her relationship with Quinn. And she uses the exact same word to describe it. And she continues to rationalize the reasons why she brought him into their home, whether or not they were misguided or not. Like, I think we can all agree they were good-hearted. And, like, she did it out of a place of love, at least, you know, at the very least, out of a place of love. But then the therapist turns right back around and is like, but Carey, like, you have a four-year-old child, and like, sometimes the four-year-old child needs to come first. And I thought, once again, the same as they did in episode 7, they were like turning that relationship and the way she felt about him into something that was not rational. I felt that they did the exact same thing in not the last episode, but the one before that. I'm just putting it out there. You know, what do you guys, I mean, do you guys think that they're trying to draw some sort of a parallel between those two relationships at the very least, if not in the way that Carey talks about them and refers to her feelings towards these two men, then about the way that people talk to her about them?
I'm just going to, I'll talk a little bit about when you watch it from a Carey Quinn relationship perspective. I don't know. I think for the most part, our little corner of the fandom being Tumblr, that at least, I think somehow it felt like it was sort of validating. It was weird because so much of the fandom really detests Brody and spends a lot of time and probably too much energy focusing on how much they detest Brody. But because we know Gonza and Claire and the canon really put him up on something of a pedestal as a character and as the narrative, I think that her drawing a parallel between them in her therapy session felt really validating for Carey Quinn. And there was this meta aspect of it. There was a huge meta aspect of it too, which is like, we've heard Gonza in interviews talking about the parallels, and then he finally put it into the narrative, right? He actually just explained it, which, you know, so often Homeland is so withholding and economical in what they do and how they explain things. And so it just felt really, that part felt really good.
Why did it feel good to you? I'm sorry. I can't understand how it was validating. I'm struggling to understand that.
Well, it was validating because we understand, whether we want to acknowledge it or not, we understand that for the writers and for many of the actors, Brody represented for her, whether we make this kind of these motherly criticisms of her that it was a misguided relationship, which is our own problem as a fandom, as far as I'm concerned, you know, whether or not we make those criticisms, we understand that Gonza and Claire and Cannon regarded this as a really epic, you know, epic love affair for her. And it was all consuming. And whether we think it's misguided, I think that's kind of beside the point. We understand that they understand its importance. And so what it said to me was that the writers were saying, we understand Carrie and Quinn's importance. And so when you watch it from a Carrie Quinn perspective, that came out to me loud and clear, and that did feel like a validation. I mean, yeah, we can get in the weeds around, yeah, but Carrie and Brody was dysfunctional, and now they're drawing a line between how Carrie and Quinn are dysfunctional. But Carrie and Quinn is now, and Carrie and Brody was then, and it's better she wants to keep him alive now, and she was willing to send Brody to his death then. I mean, there's lots of places to go with this discussion, but I think the big picture is... The big picture to me was that it was a sort of a recognition that this was, and as it should be, Carrie and Brody lasted for 3 seasons, and we're now on 5 for some version of Quinn and Carrie. So in some ways, to me, actually, I didn't regard it as, I thought it was great. My world wasn't shaken by it. I thought it was, I thought it was kind of stating the obvious, because I don't spend a lot of time being insecure about Carrie and Quinn, right?
So like, that's I'm confused, because I think that the writers have been crystal clear about the importance of the Carrie Quinn relationship. And before this, like, didn't they say at Paley this past year, so in 2016, that like the Carrie Quinn relationship, I felt like the writers have not been withholding about the importance of that relationship, if perhaps not like in canon, then like in press and media and all this other junk. Like, that to me was not something that I needed like canon like validation or support for. I think that we are supposed to get in the weeds on this, and the like Alex Gonza and Claire and all the writers, they were clear about Carrie and Brody being this epic love affair, but they were also clear about it being a doomed relationship, which is why I continue to be confused about people being like excited and validated by the writers through the extension of the scene, drawing the line from her relationship with Brody to her relationship with Quinn, because to me, I think it's more foreboding than like, you know, like a good thing, because the Carrie Brody relationship was doomed and tragic, and now they're like comparing it to the Carrie Quinn relationship, and to me, my mind just goes to that one thing. I already believe that it was important.
My mind goes straight to the importance of Quinn to her, which she really only kind of recognized and accepted last season. I mean, we don't know what happened during those 2.5 years. But
I'm a little bit flummoxed right now, because
see, I don't get the I get where you're going, Sarah. I understand why you're like, well, because you see, you know, someday we should dredge up in the entrails of this fandom, we should dredge up someone who used to watch the show just for Brody, just for entertainment. Well, like just for entertainment's sake on these discussions, because I think it would be fascinating, because you see it so through Carrie's perspective. So you're really critical of Carrie you're really critical of Brody because you see it through Carrie's perspective. I'm really like somewhat critical of Brody because I see it through a Quinn Carrie perspective. Right. But what's interesting is I didn't think they were quite doing that. I didn't think they were quite saying, well, you know, Carrie Brody was doomed and her, you know, I felt like what she said about him had an intimacy about it and a heartfelt.
I'm not denying that. I'm saying from the standpoint of the writers, like writing that scene, like, yes, we can all agree that her speaking those words. I mean, yes, she's the character within this story, but she doesn't really know what's going to happen in the future. But writing that scene had a purpose. And I don't think it can just be to acknowledge the importance of the Carrie Quinn relationship in the narrative, because they've already done that. Like, they have done that repeatedly. And so instead...
So you thought it was drawing a parallel between how foreboding the relationships could both be.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, Carrie is not saying, like, my relationship with Brody ended badly, and I believe my relationship with Quinn will end. Like, I don't think it was that. I think it was perhaps the writers, like, suggesting that. Like, I think it's worth considering. And I mean, I wonder, all these people who were so excited and, like, validated by it, is it because they, I mean, which is kind of ironic in the first place, because those people, not all of them, but I'm sure a number of them, have at the same time criticized the very things about the Carrie Brody relationship that is now, like, validating the Carrie Quinn relationship. But I wonder if she was...
Oh, that is such a fascinating statement. Oh my God, I can't even think about that.
I feel like that's kind of obvious.
It's true. We excuse him for everything, and we blame Brody for the same shit. I mean, it is...
No, I'm just saying, like...
That's fascinating. Like,
you know, everyone's getting so excited about Carrie using the word intense to describe her relationship with Quinn the same as she did with Brody, right? And so if she loved Brody, that must mean that, you know, she's in love with Quinn. But, like, those same people also criticized the intensity of their relationship when it was in season 3, and when, you know, Quinn was sort of shoved aside. I don't know. I just think that
I guess my takeaway from it was more that Carrie was explaining to some extent how her decisions mattered. And she had she was saying that, well, the choices that I made directly led to Brody's death, and
the choices
I'm trying to make are trying to keep Quinn alive.
That's the Carrie as a character,
the Carrie ego.
That's Carrie as a human person trying to explain something to her therapist. I'm talking more from the standpoint of, like...
Don't dismiss it. Don't dismiss
it. I'm not dismissing
that,
it, but the you part
are,
that I'm...
You're both dismissing it. It's Carrie as a grown-up. She's grown up in the last, whatever, in canon, 4 years,
How am I dismissing
right?
it?
Well, because you're both like, well, that's just, like, or at least Sarah's like, oh, yeah, that's just what Carrie does to rationalize shit. No. She's a grown-up
That is
now.
Not what
She's
I said. That's not what I said. I'm saying that... I think the level that people might be viewing this is at the human level, i.e. this is Carrie as a person talking to her therapist. And what do the words that she says, what does that betray about what she's thinking and feeling? And I think that's interesting. And I think that it's clear too, right? That there's that she loved Brody, and that she's trying to prevent the thing that she felt occurred with Brody with Quinn. Like, yes, that's clear. I think that's objective. What I think is more interesting is from the standpoint of actually this being a narrative and this being a TV show where she's a character, you know, on a journey, and we're nearing the end of the season, and what do the words that she's saying that the writers wrote in a script, what does that mean? From the standpoint of, it's the first scene of the episode, and it's a very, I don't know, it's a pretty intense scene. I don't like to use that word because I feel like it has, like, a different meaning in the context of the scene, but, like, this was a scene in an episode of TV, and what do the words that they chose specifically for her to say, what meaning do they have in the narrative at large, is just the layer that I'm looking at. I'm not dismissing her words. I'm just saying that
there's a larger part
I think is more interesting.
Well, so you know what I think they're doing with the narrative? And I think we had an ask in the last 24 hours. I think what they're doing in the narrative is they are setting I'm taking this in a different direction, this discussion. I think they're setting up the narrative that she may not choose Franny at the end of the season.
Oh my God. Wait, you think that she's going to choose Quinn over Franny?
I don't know if it'll be that clear, but I think that she'll choose the CIA and she may choose, she may decide that
Someone sent that in. Yeah. That to me is like,
That's been discussed. That's been discussed on LiveJournal. And I think it's, I think
what do really people think?
People have
about that.
Well, smart people. Personally, I don't think there's anyone who's not smart on LiveJournal. It's great discussions, but there's at least a handful of people who were like, that would be the most unexpected ending. And there was something, dialogue's always nuanced on Homeland, but there was something about that session with her therapist in which it seems a little bit pat for us to just go along into the end of the season and have her be like, well, of course she'll get Franny back and of course she'll choose Franny. That's what we're all assuming. And it's fucking Homeland, right?
Oh, yeah. The previews and from the scene that they released with her and Max and next week's episode, that like Carrie is definitely like gonna miss that visit. Like that just seems like she's going to go to the deposition and then she's going to, like, it just, like, it's the writing's on the wall there. But, like, the idea of Carrie choosing the CIA over Franny, even if it would be incredibly interesting from, like, a narrative standpoint, because it'd be like, well, I don't know. It would just make you think for, like, an entire year about what that means. But if she did do that, it just makes me uncomfortable. Like, that's worse than, that's nearly as bad as, like, the series finale that I've been kind of rattling around in my brain where she closes the series in a psych ward, like, and Franny is, like, lost forever. Like, that's nearly as bad.
No, that's not going to happen. I think it would be surprising if she, the trouble with saying, no, I can't be a mom to Carrie and do this job, is that it's a little bit what she did in season 4. So that's the only reason.
Yeah, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Like, I could almost even envision if the writing's possibly on the wall and it's like she's not going to get Franny back or something like that, and she just lets that happen instead of fights it because it means that she could go back to the CIA. Like, I could see them doing that. Even I would despise that storyline, but I wouldn't be totally surprised if they did that just because it's fucking Homeland, man.
Right. Well, back to your original topic, which, not to belabor it, because I do think it's sort of, it's hard to kind of bring it to a place that has a kind of productive endpoint, because we just don't know where it'll go. Quinn has been in such a bad state. It was clearly, I see the parallels to Tower of David all over the place. And the level they like to, we've talked a lot about.
That would be an interesting post.
Oh my God. Of all the different gift sets we've talked about, I can't believe we haven't gone there. Yeah.
It's like, if you want the Brody Quinn parallels, there you go.
We've got him smoking up. We've got him, yeah.
Oh, God. I didn't even
We've got him doing
that.
Drugs. We've got him. I mean, it's clearly, like, I don't even think they've been particularly subtle about it. They're definitely taking, and they've even said, to reporters, we're doing with Quinn what we couldn't do. We kind of got them to similar places of defeated soldiers and, warriors that were terribly, tortured by what they'd gone through. And then we had to end Brody because of all sorts of other reasons. And we can continue with Quinn. So that's what, I don't know, if you layered that idea onto the therapy session, right? I guess I didn't feel the same kind of pathos that you might be feeling, Sarah, because I didn't feel like, I felt like she was trying to be an adult so hard. She was like, look, I'm trying to be a mother. I'm trying to save this man for whom I love. It's therapy. It's not like it ended with any particularly, uplifting note. In fact, it was a little scary because I'm in the middle of doing the director's chair feature, And they fade, the only time in that entire episode they don't do a hard cut from scene to scene is at the end of the therapy session, where they do a fade out of her full-faced into Dar. And the last line of that therapy session is the therapist saying, you know, something like, you have to, you know, a four-year-old needs to be put first. And then they rest on her face and they end the scene. And then it fades, which is the only time they do like a fade in where you can see both people. So you can see her and then you can see Dar coming into focus for the next scene, entering the president's office. And that's where I was like, wow, why did you choose to do that, guys? Like, I don't know. I mean, they may have just thought it was, they may have just thought it was Artie. I don't know.
I don't want to think about these things.
I just have to say, I think that the fade in is even more significant than you're making it out to be, because this show doesn't, like, hardly ever does that. I mean, I can count the number of times that they've done a fade in and out, like, on probably one hand in 5+ seasons. And whenever it is, it's fairly significant. Like, there was this one, which I agree, it was kind of creepy. Like, you can see
it was foreboding. It was really, yeah, when I was like, damn, she may not be choosing Franny, because it was off of Franny comment, yeah. Right? Yeah, or something.
Yes, I mean, it's at the conclusion of that therapy scene, and her face is on the left, and Dar's from behind is on the right, and he's wearing a suit, and he's kind of all in shadows or whatever, and there's a point where both of their faces are on the screen, and it's a pretty slow fade too, so it's like pretty obvious like what's happening. And the the only other times I could think where they like use the fade, obviously there was in 5/12 last year with the fade in and out of White, which was crazy on its own, but not like a true fade where there's like two scenes being superimposed on each other. The time after that was in 3/12, so in the season 3 finale, and I remember this very distinctly because in the commentary on the episode on the season 3 DVDs, they had the guy who edited the episode, and he talked about how their use of the fade, and they do it in the scene right before. So it's the scene right after she sees Saul at the memorial ceremony and they hug, and then he turns around and she looks behind her and
he's leaving.
Yeah. And she sees him walk out the door, and then she turns around and walks the other way. And then the scene right after that is the scene where she's coming up from the ops room, and then she draws a star on the wall, and they use a fade there too. And I remember the editor specifically called out the fact that, like, you'll probably never see like a fade on the show again, because it's just stylistically kind of not of
what they do. Yeah,
the show. Yeah, so I thought it was very significant. Well,
by the way, did you notice the music right there?
I did. What's it from? It sounded really familiar, but I couldn't place it.
It's from 5/12. It's fucking from 5/12. It's that creepy, weird music they do. That's they used it all through 5/12.
It sounded super familiar.
Pardon?
I said it sounded super familiar.
Yeah, no, it's they used it throughout 5/12. It's that kind of it's too bad we can't do more audio on Tumblr.
It's like sad piano music.
It's more ethereal than that. They didn't use it in the very end scene in 5/12, but they used it in various places where it was just there were several scenes in 5/12 which were kind of sort of odd and anyway, anyone who's listening to this podcast, go back and look at the end of the therapy scene. And there's plenty of people in the fandom who have watched too much of 5/12 when we were trying to figure out if the man was alive. And they will recognize that music. And I was like, guys, what are you doing between the fade out and the use of that music? I got a little freaked out, I gotta say. I didn't come to any grand conclusions, but
my conclusion is that we're all fucked.
My conclusion is that Sean Callery just reuses a lot of shit in the show.
Good. Not to mention, doesn't he borrow from 24 too?
Sean Callery's music.
He does not use the same music between the shows, does he?
Yes, he does.
No. He uses the same motifs though.
There are points
in Homeland where I can literally say I have heard this on 24 before, and it'll be a little bit different, but just different enough. And I've been watching the new 24 Legacy, and he's so much better at doing music for 24. Like, he just doesn't like Homeland that much.
He's probably bored.
I really love the score on this show.
When Quinn was going into quinning mode, and they focus on him as he's leaving the lake house and they like do that whole thing. I know it was super tropey and it was super like, you know, hero goes into action mode in a dangerous way, but I was like, God, this is awesome. The music just rocked my world.
Yeah, I liked it too.
His music for 24 is next level. Like, he has been acclaimed for that forever. They have released the scores of 24 on more than one occasion because it sells well, and it's just the instrumental music. You don't see that very often.
Okay, I would listen, like, I would buy an album of his scores for Homeland.
You would buy most things for Homeland, Sarah.
Okay, he does the one score at, okay, it's the one that I truly love. It's the score from The Vest where Saul is putting up all the stuff onto the board and he figures out that it's a timeline. The music that plays there, like, rocked my shit when I was in school. I mean, it's really short. It's like 58 seconds long or something like that, but I had the audio, and whenever I needed to like do work for school, I turned that on and played it on repeat. It was like my "you need to get shit done" like song. I love that one. And
boy,
I'll send it to you. I titled it Fallow Yellow. That's not the real name, it's just what I called it. And then I love the one that he did at the end of The Star. Like, that one is beautiful. It's beautiful. Whenever I'm on a plane, I listen to it and I cry. But that's a different thing. I like his music for the show.
I like it too. I just think that he's maybe not as careful about it sometimes as he is with his other work.
Okay.
Can we talk about quinning?
We've lost everyone in our like discussion of the minute show.
We went on a score.
I wish Ashley was still asleep.
We went on like a Sean Callery deep dive. That's awesome. But for God's sakes, can we talk about quitting?
I just have to say that last week we went into a very deep dive about Brody and it turned out to be extremely prescient. So I don't care. Like, next week there's going to be like a major musical moment and we're going to all look like geniuses. So
we are geniuses.
Yeah. Well,
I don't know if we're geniuses, but I do think we're discussing things that aren't discussed other places. So that makes me happy.
No one else wants to discuss them with me.
I have learned, this is sort of an age thing with me too, is there are other times in my history where I would have been much more agenda driven and been like, why the hell does this discussion never have any fucking order? And in fact, I've actually learned, you know what? Plenty of people are listening to this thing, way more people than I ever think should listen to my voice. But you know what? People like it, and that's good. We've gotten awesome feedback from the last one, in which I was half drunk by the end. So.
Oh, I usually am.
There were a few sound bites that were fairly audible of you pouring wine. Like, at least
I just
twice.
I just had a sip of wine. That's so funny. But I'm actually very soberish. So I know. Well, as it goes on. So I am going to make you both talk about quinning because I almost stood up and cheered. I don't know what, I don't know if it takes that much analysis or discussion, but I think we should probably talk about Astrid, and the scene was fantastically evocative and I thought beautifully done.
What a fucking use of Nina Haas.
I know.
I am so...
She got to be the dead girl this episode.
Like, at least she got paid for it. Like, that's how, yeah, I sort of felt about Rupert Friend in season 5. Like, for the last half of it, he had just the easiest paycheck in the world.
It's true. So,
you gotta know there were jokes,
yeah,
about,
so
that.
Last week we weren't treated to ranting Ashley about how the show is anti-feminist, so... Are we going to get a rant this week about that?
I mean, we can. I'm writing a whole thing about it, but I don't really know what you guys said in the last one because I don't listen to our podcasts.
We talked about how they can't do a Women in Homeland panel with just two women on it.
You can't do a fucking Women in Homeland panel and have it be two women and just like a dude. Like, you can't do that. That's not okay.
That's not really a panel. It's like two women talking. Like, there's no panel.
Two women being asked questions by a man about their show. Like, this whole entire fucking show is based on men's reactions to the things that women do and why that matters.
Whoa! That's a statement?
Yeah, including with Carrie. I want to continue hearing this. We talked about how they can't do a Women in Homeland panel with just two women. We talked about how they continue to kill women in the service of man pain, which is really fucked up, and how they're like, the writer's room is not, I mean, they have Charlotte this year, Meredith the previous 2 years, like, they've only ever had one woman on the staff. And while I actually think that Carrie is very well written, I think we both came to the conclusion that they justify, well, we have this incredible woman at the center of the show and we tell really great stories about her, so who fucking
Why
cares
bother?
About anyone else?
Yeah. So we covered those things, Ashley. Anything else you want to, like,
anything else we missed?
I don't really know what you missed. I just think that this is a bullshit example of a feminist show, and I didn't really think too much about it until I, in the very series finale of the original 24, I cried because I was like, this show fucking hates women so much. And then on rewatch, I was like, you know what? This show actually is pretty awesome when it comes to women. It's just, you know, Jack Bauer's poison penis. Like, we're going to talk about Carrie's toxic vagina. We're going to talk about Jack Bauer's poison penis. And every woman he's with, pretty much, has a bad ending. Or, like, they break up and she gets to live happily ever after. But anyone he loves dies.
How much do you think? So, I'm wondering if it's a correlation but not causation. So maybe the reason... I'm serious. I have a point.
No, I know.
Oh my God. Sarah, do you work in technology? Are you kind of left-brained? Okay, good. Let's go there.
So,
awesome.
But maybe the reason that all the relationships Jack Bauer was in ended poorly was not because the show hated women, but because they were telling the story of a tragic male character. I've never seen the show, but I don't know. But it's possible that they're doing the same thing. Well, for Carrie, that doesn't
really
count.
Well, they're not doing the same thing.
You couldn't claim
that. I mean, they might be doing it with Carrie. But, like, on 24, they had so many incredible women who... They would be just normal women who would step up and do extraordinary things, or women who were leaders, women who were in charge, women who made sacrifices. And they were completely on equal ground with men so much of the time. And they treated women badly sometimes, but overall, it was very much a show where people were equal. And on Homeland, that's not so much the case.
But don't you think that's more realistic? Like, I mean...
I don't care if it's more realistic. This is entertainment.
Like, I think that Quinn the writers have committed right themselves to telling a story that is generally, and I used like the word generally in quotes because it's a very loose generally, but I think they wanted to portray that she faced a lot of sexism within the CIA and like what that was like to be like a young attractive woman in this like old boys club. Maybe I'm giving too much credit.
The point about female exceptionalism has been made. Are you about to bring this up?
No, what I was about to say is I think Sarah has a point in that if you're going to do a more realistic portrayal of the CIA, I think on the higher ranks it probably is a boys' club, and Carrie.
But
is
don't fucking do what you did to Allison or Astrid. No, for or sure. Mira. I agree. Like that's bullshit.
We're not going to argue about that. Where I pause, and this is a little bit of a behind the scenes issue. Where I pause is that, you know, this season. Let's just take this season for example. They put her with Retta. Like, I'm sorry, I actually think Carrie might have found a, you know, it's a fucking nonprofit. Women run nonprofits. Like, it's like 80% run by women and nonprofits. It's a Muslim advocacy nonprofit. I don't know if anyone went to the Women's March, but there were like 25 Muslim nonprofits. And as far as I could tell, they were all run by women who spoke. Like, so, and you have Retta. And then you have Conlon. I think actually the FBI is pretty even between men and women. And so what I think that they narratively do is they put Claire with men. I don't know if it's part of the canon that's important to them or if it's part of the actress just because they know she plays really well that way or if it's sexier to them.
Or maybe it's the fact that Carrie doesn't know how to interact around other females. So maybe she's self-selected. Picking a male lawyer to run the foundation with because that's the type of people she's more comfortable around. Like, that's the explanation. Carrie doesn't have female friends. So, like, I mean...
But they make the argument that she does in that stupid Homeland panel. They were like, oh my God, it's just so great, Judith Woods. Like, not the one, Women in Homeland one. It was the Paley one with Judith Warner. And she was like, what was so interesting was how this season, meaning season 5, they really explored your relationship and your friendships with women. And I was like, really?
Judith Warner doesn't get the show, so I don't care what she said.
Oh, stop! We're not going to debate Judith Warner, but I paused on that. I was like, what female friendship? Like, where? How? Tell me.
I feel like Claire is usually pretty, like, facetious about the fact that Carrie has no female friends. Like, wasn't that the same panel where she
her
said
cross,
that, like,
yeah, like
the crossbody bag was, like, her best friend? They're pretty straight about the fact that Carrie does not interact with other women her age or even women that, like, aren't her age. Like, we saw the scene with Keen when they were having from the beginning the season. Right, exactly. And it was so weird. It was like these two women clearly have, like, never really had female friends before. And this is, like, them doing an imitation of, like, what they think a dinner between two female friends is like. That's what that scene was.
Well, it was also an episode written by a dude.
Well,
I'm sorry. Like,
it's worth pointing that out every single time. Really
you can
is.
Say that about, like, literally, like, 80% of the
episode. That's
of
the fucking problem, Sarah.
I know, but it's just like, it was also an episode written by a dude. Like, every episode of the show is written by a dude.
Exactly. So, I don't know. I love the show, obviously. I think it's really important if you love something to acknowledge its flaws. And this just makes me, like, I love Cynthia. I don't think she loves her dog enough. I acknowledge her flaws.
I'm going to
send you a
picture.
Now's the time where we all go around and say each other's flaws that we just think of each other. This is going to get really deep.
Cynthia thinks I'm batshit crazy, which is not inaccurate.
What did you just say as I'm sending you a picture of this dog on my lap? My goddamn dog is on my lap, okay?
So this is the picture that you use for the podcast.
Moving on. So none of us were a fan of Dead Astrid on the Couch. What do we think of Quinn, like literally smearing her blood onto his lip? That was bizarre.
It's funny because I answered the first ask on that. We got an ask on that, and I had gone, my mind went immediately to his smearing his blood in Homeland love style. Only on the, like, what's wrong with us that we love a show in which you have to smear blood instead of declaring love for someone? But I went immediately to 504.
Yep.
And then what was interesting is that we got another ask later in which we could nuance it, because I think two of you like messaged me and we were like, war paint. So, I mean, I think
that's
all
like
the
literal
above,
interpretation
right?
of that, because he smears the blood and then he goes into full like soldier mode. Like that was the literal symbolism of it. If symbolism can, like, it was like the very kind of apparent.
I thought it was intimately shot. I mean, she had a heart wound and
he seemed kind of in like a trance though. It was kind of weird. It was just weird.
Well, my original interpretation of it was that, like, originally as I was watching it and I was sort of surprised at the end to see him shuffling out at like full speed, was that he was going to present himself as a victim and use her blood in the way that he was doing for Carrie. That he was going to, I mean, I guess it doesn't make sense now. I'm actually watching it at this moment.
Okay.
Because I haven't watched the show yet. I haven't rewatched it yet. I get very tired of this show after, like, it takes me a little while to rewatch.
That's understandable. Yeah, it was just kind of bizarre. Like, his behavior this season is kind of weird.
I have so many thoughts, and I'm not productive on the matter I need to keep my mouth shut. I got accused of ableism this week, which, by the way, I deserve it. Yeah. I kind of knew it was coming.
Yeah, I don't know. Not even in the context of his physical condition. And I don't know. It's just the way he's, like, smearing the blood on his lip is just a weird thing to do. That's just a weird thing to me.
Oh, yes, these characters behave completely normally. In every other aspect of their lives.
It just seems so... It seemed very...
Like, people totally just, like, handcuff themselves to bricks and, like, try to jump into the water. Like, that's a normal thing to do.
Don't joke about that. Then you'll be accused of being insensitive to people with mental illness who are actually suicidal.
Oh, my God, no. I have mental illness. I'm super crazy. I'm medicated. I'm the only person on the Hell Yeah Homeland staff who is actually, like, mentally ill. So, I get a pass.
Well,
I did not get a pass. I was accused of shaming people who are suicidal. So, because I was like, that was kind of weird that he did that.
Well, the thing was, he wasn't suicidal. He was just like doing this. Go ahead.
It was cartoonish. I don't like it. No. You keep this in, Sarah. I'm going to ask you to get, you do whatever you need to do with editing, because we don't get involved with that. But I'm telling you, that whole, like, diving into, like, trash dumpsters and cinder block, you know, like that whole thing was, I am convinced that the direction, I'm convinced that, like, Rupert was laughing at it. I'm convinced that, like, the whole thing was so over the top.
Okay, so very, like, very quick story about that episode as a whole, and then we can move on to, like, actually what happened this week is, that's probably, like, my least favorite episode of all of season 5 and like possibly of the series. It makes me so uncomfortable, and the blog kind of presence, or like the way that I reacted to the episode on the blog was not entirely sensitive, and it was just like a whole big fucking mess, and I never rewatched it. I still haven't rewatched the entire thing to this day, but I did have to make the gif of Rupert, like, climbing into the trash can a few weeks ago for the blog. And so I had to rewatch that scene. And I was like, what the fuck? This actually happened. He is like clutching onto this dumpster and like rolling through the streets of Berlin, like doubled over in pain. And I was like, what the fresh hell is this? It was so weird. And I was like, I'm never watching this episode again. Like, that was, it was, I was like, no, this is no, this is no.
Do you know, I mean, like, as the resident Quinn viewer here, I was laughing too. And it's not because I've had people who are suicidal in my life and I have been at hospitals at 2 a.m. for them. Like, it's not because I'm an insensitive person. It was because of how that was portrayed within the narrative that seemed so over the top. Like, I couldn't even get my head around.
I think part of the problem was that Quinn wasn't suicidal.
Yeah.
Like, he was, it wasn't depression. He wasn't trying to kill himself because he didn't want to be on this planet anymore. He was trying to do that because he was trying to save Carrie. And he thought he was going to die anyway.
Yeah, it was so weird. Okay, I don't want to talk about this. It just makes me uncomfortable all over again. Literally, that episode is, it's like,
I kind of love it for its sheer, like, absurd, like, its sheer, like, madness.
Mid-season 5 is, like, the darkest timeline. It's, like, Wig, Quinn doing, like, who the fuck knows what, like, Jonas and Quinn, like, in the same scenes, which is just, like, eh. And then, oh, it just, like, it's really dark.
Do you know, I always reflect upon, there's an interview at some point with Alex Gonzo when he said he went to South Africa for the filming of the last couple episodes of season 4. And he was like, you know, I was really concerned, which was a proper concern, actually, because the character of Hakani was almost cartoonish, right? But he was like, we were really worried that this guy who was going to storm the American embassy was just going to be way over the top. And so, you know, so he talks in some interview about struggling with that. And then he ended up going for it. And as far as I was concerned, I thought that piece of television was fantastic. I do think Hakani's character was almost veered into cartoonish. Like, it was actually a little bit hard to hate him as much as we should have, right? Because of the makeup and everything. But the fact that he could reflect on that, and that we've heard no off story about Quinn trying to, like, dunk himself into a fucking, like, dumpster.
Okay, so Quinn doing his Quinn things, war paint or blood or whatever you want to call it, his declaration of love for Astrid, and then robbing the gun store, which, how the fuck can you buy those, like, sniper rifles in, like, a general sporting goods store? I was like, what the hell? How's that legal?
I looked it up. I know. No one wants to know this answer, but I know.
I was like, this is insane that those, like, guns are just sitting there for people to buy or steal.
It's a 1994 exemption. That's why it had the title of the gun store with like servicing gun owners since 1994. So I was like, okay, I'll be my X-Files nerdishness, and I was like, New York gun law, 1994, on Google. Thank X-Files, you, Google
drink.
Machine.
I just drank.
It turns out there was an exemption for, like, fucking machine guns that dated from 1994 until, I don't know, at some other juncture. So used gun stores can still, like, sell basically machine guns because of some NRA, you know, shit fest. And so it's a real thing, I'm telling you.
The NRA shit
fest. I will link it for people, but I like the realism of it. I mean, I liked it. That's very X-Files for me. It made me happy. But yeah, that's how he got.
I'm taking a drink.
Yes. I drank because Cynthia mentioned the X-Files.
Did you drink when I was talking about 24? You must have had like a whole glass.
I probably did. But I didn't register it as this is the podcast drinking game.
Yeah, you haven't talked about Brett Marling yet.
I have not talked about her in at least like 10 episodes. So it's no,
true. You haven't talked about her for a very long time. Okay, so I'll dive in there with Quinn. So I'm not sure if it's that discussion worthy, but I have to say from a just pure viewer standpoint, having him go, and we should, can we talk about both him quinning, which I thought was done really well, but featured all these kind of long shots of his body, which I thought was interesting because I think they're focusing still on his disabilities. And it was fun, right? Like the cool thing, the thing about quinning is that it's fun and like no one really wants to say goodbye to that. So it was
catharsis. I hate that word.
I know you hate those words, but I don't mind quinning. There's many other words I don't like, but there is something about, it was like a catharsis for viewers. Like I really felt like those of us who like love him were just like, oh my God, thank God. It was just like the biggest exhale ever. It was just go dude. And then we got to the Dar scene, which has to be discussed. As a black cloud of doom goes over this discussion, it does need to be discussed. And I think before we get too tired and before too much time goes on.
I've had so much sleep. It's great. I'm good.
Are you? Can you take it away? Because I'm not.
I'm totally good right now.
Well, but what's interesting is you deviated from everyone else on the blog about what you thought that scene meant with Dar. It was super clear to me. It was actually a confirmation of our worst fears.
I don't know. So I'll let Ashley say, because she actually does have a strong opinion and she'll be able to articulate it much better. But like, I'm not like 100% sold on either direction. I think they're leaving it very ambiguous in like a really creepy and disgusting way. Like there's no question that some kind of abuse took place, but I think that they're being, I don't know, like they're not, and maybe it's unrealistic to expect that they would just come out and be like, he sexually abused him, and it'd be like that clear cut. But some of the things he said in this episode, I felt like in episode 7, they left it open-ended enough that you could draw your own conclusions and be like, okay, he said these things and I believe this. Like there was enough room either way to kind of make an argument. And I feel like this episode, it was a little bit clearer just in terms of the things he was saying, like, I love you, you're my child, I would never hurt you. Like the those kinds of things, which are of course classic kind of, it's like
abuser phrases.
Yes. It's abuser dialogue. Like that's not a question. There's no question that he abused him at the very least psychologically, and that Quinn was witness to something abusive, whether it was firsthand or secondhand, I think remains an open question. And I think that, I don't know if they want us, I think that they're intending for it to be a little bit more ambiguous than some of us have come to believe that it is, which I don't think is any fault of our interpretation, or really a fault of their writing. I think it's just, Dar is just such a evil, he's such an evil person that it's easy to go that far because you believe that he would be capable of that. But I don't know. I guess I feel I'm conflicted on this.
I believe Dar to be capable of a lot of things. After episode 7, I said, oh my God, like there was definitely sexual abuse here. I sent people emails with links to a book about grooming that I had personal experience with, and I was completely sold on it. I cannot wrap my head around the language that was used in this episode, because I cannot believe to any extent that a person who said, will say in the same sentence, you are my child, and more than that, and be reflecting on an intimate relationship. I cannot get my head around that. That well, just is that because is, too is that
because
much.
Of you personally? Because you,
no, that just, it's because that's just because
that's classic grooming.
It's grooming. It's grooming, but it's not like, why would you reflect on that 20 years later in that way? You are my child, and also we had an intimate relationship. That's disgusting. Like,
but that's the point, right?
I know. The point, the action is disgusting. I don't feel like you can talk about it that casually.
Oh, so, oh.
Like, if someone's, I think that's a good distinction.
You don't feel like Dara is someone who could be, who could,
I don't
say,
feel like Dara is somebody who could, like, say,
you're my child, dot, dot, dot.
And I
more
fucked
than
you.
That. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, he would never himself
that
put
was,
those two.
That's what I was trying to get to earlier, yeah, in a conversation, like, in a personal conversation, and people were like, no, this happens all the time. And I was like, no, he was talking way too casually about it. And Quinn had a gun pointed at him. Like, you're my child more than that. If you're saying that, then that's just more reason to pull the trigger.
Well, first of all, how is it a casual conversation when there's a gun pointed at your head?
It's a casual statement.
I'm mostly just laughing at Homeland, right? Like, we regard casual conversation as a gun.
No, but I understand your point. Your point is that he says it. Just the fact that he would say those two things in like the same breath, and
exactly,
and it would. It's either you say one or the other, not both of them. And if you say both of them, then you're almost acknowledging your own monstrousness.
So I
exactly.
would say,
yeah.
so what I would, what
like
I
you
would,
might say, I love you more than that, or like you're my child more than that. I don't know. I can't put all those three things together.
It's like you could either say, I love you, you're my child, or I love you, like, I love you
more than that.
Yeah. Or just like you would leave out the child part from like the creepy love part of it. And we don't feel like
those
Dar
three
is
things
someone
like, kinda...
who. Yeah. Yeah. I understand.
Dar is not
saying.
A good person. He's not a good person. He has so many issues. He has done terrible things. And I believe he's done more terrible things than we can even
Although,
really articulate.
Kind of a weird
but
twist.
I don't feel like he would casually bring it up this way.
But can I intervene a little bit in this and just say that I think you have to I did not want to, but I, for feature reasons on the blog, rewatched that scene 3 times today. I think that the combination of him, Dar approaches him, like Dar approaches him with he's holding a gun. Dar approaches him. Focus on, rewatch the scene. I challenge anyone listening to this or you guys. Dar approaches him with full confidence, knowing that he will not pull the trigger, and says, I love you. You are, you know, my child, more than that. And, you know, pull the trigger if you don't believe that. It was so epically manipulative, and yeah, you can put a veneer of the CIA on it. You can do whatever you want. But if you focus on Rupert's acting, because it's so easy to focus on Dar in that scene, because we're all like, how much of a dirty old man are you? Like, did this really happen? Because frankly, that's all what we're sort of wrapped around. I just watched it, and it was so hard to see it as, in my lens anyway, as anything but what we've been told. And I know it's Homeland, and I know never to believe what we've been told exactly. So Ashley, I'm with you. I get that it seems almost too obvious, but it's really awful.
And see, I don't think it's obvious. I think that it is the opposite. I think that they are actually taking a step back from what they set up in episode 7.
Or
I think with those three lines put together, I think that they are taking an active step back from saying, yes, Dar sexually abused Quinn.
Did you focus
I think what
on
they're saying,
Quinn's reaction?
The issue with that is that both of those episodes were written months before the 7th episode aired. Like, it's hard for me to believe.
I mean, I assume the seventh episode was still written before the ninth episode.
Right. But I guess what I'm saying is if they intended in the seventh episode to suggest that Dar was abusive to others in the group, but not to Quinn specifically, and then a bunch of people had a different impression, it's not like they wrote episode 9 after witnessing the reaction once.
Oh no, I'm not saying that aired. Was reactionary. I'm just saying that they knew what they were setting up in episode 7 and they were right. walking it back in episode 9.
Oh. Right, which is
it doesn't, that doesn't make take like, a genius to make that determination.
Why not just have it at the same level? Like, if they really intended it to be one thing. Because I think
they really wanted people to question how bad Dara Dal is. And the answer is actually bad.
That is a good point, because there's this twist at the end of the episode where, like, Dar had no idea that the guy in the hat, like, went out there to kill them. And he was like, what the fuck? Like, why would you do that? And that was something that we thought was completely sort of plotted and planned by him, but it obviously wasn't. So someone else is trying to kill them.
This is such a deviation from what we're talking about, but there's great spy plotting conversations around whether Dar was calling because he knew Quinn would be on the line and realized he had been outplayed, and you know, called him on an open line on purpose. Called Belly. Let's just call him Belly. Like, I don't know. Everyone Why wants to call him the guy him in the hat.
That's not like, his name.
He's on the closed captions as Belly.
As like, Belly.
Really? Yeah,
he is Belly. Yeah. Cass's Belly. Yes. So when it goes to closed captions, I'm not worried about spoilers. So yeah, he's the dude, and
although
so
they did miss Don Max's name in closed captions.
I know. Son of Peter, by the way. That's his last
yeah,
name.
Yeah, I was ready to comment to you guys that it was not P-I-O-T, and then I read the resume. They spelled it differently in the captions.
I know. Well, no, we were having a chat. So anyway, that's so interesting. Max is so interesting in this episode. We should not leave that alone. Because, no. Oh my God, Max! But yeah, there's a whole dialogue going on, and it takes too long to go into for this discussion, and maybe not that interesting. But the question on the table is whether Dar called Cass's Belly, if I'm saying that right, to tell him because he knew he'd been outplayed and he realized he was not calling the shots. And so he called him on an open line because he knew Quinn would be listening.
Well, that's the other point that I would make, is that Quinn did outplay him, and he played him from the very beginning, because Dar is saying all these things to tell him that he loves him. If you don't believe that, pull the trigger. And Quinn never had any intention of killing him in the first place because he needed to get that information.
I don't know. Watch Roop's acting. I think Roop's
whatever you
to
say about Roop's
him.
Acting and how it might have impacted the character. The point is that
plot wise, he had the
stingray or whatever, and he had a plan to get to the man who killed Astrid, and like it involved making Dar think that maybe to some extent he'd won. That maybe that Quinn really loved him back and could not go through with killing him. That was Quinn's plan. That was Quinn's side of it. And he played right into it. As soon as I saw Quinn tracking the calls, I thought, okay, well, this was his plan from the very beginning, was not to kill Dar, but to scare Dar and to
figure this out. But the question on the table is whether Dar knew, like whether Dar suddenly, I mean, would Dar, head of Black Ops or whatever covert black shit he does.
Well, he did just get hit in the head.
I read it. I've gone back to this scene a couple times, which is all this entire part is so hard to watch. But It does read to me as just a desperate old guy who was calling the dude, like, Cassius Belli, and just being like, what the fuck? What the hell were you doing? And Belli saying, I can't believe you're calling me on an open line. Like, it seemed kind of, like, straight up. But most people, and clearly people who are on LiveJournal or who are on this discussion are way too invested. But their read is that Dar would never be that dumb, that he was doing it to tip off. He realized he had been outplayed himself and that he was tipping off Quinn because he knew Quinn would know.
I don't know if this is anything, and I know it's a non sequitur.
Wait, so you're saying, sorry, I just had to interject here. You're saying that Dar, that Dar called Belli because he knew that Quinn would be tracking the call, and therefore that Quinn would go and find and kill Belli? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, okay.
That's what some people are suggesting, but I don't know that Dar would expect Quinn to have that technology. I know.
But I mean, but he's sort of in charge of these guys. He knows their technology. I don't know.
Like, if Quinn found a way to break into his apartment, like, I don't know.
The narrative reads to me like a desperate old man, and I think at some point we're supposed to believe that about Dar.
Who's pouring wine right now?
Me?
Cynthia.
I don't know. We don't know. This is where discussion on spy plotting gets silly, but we don't know. But it read to me after watching it three times as a desperate old man who had just been hit over the head by a boy he might have been in love with, and just decided to scream and shout at the hitman who, I don't know, like, the hitman was not supposed to kill him in Dar's mind. That's the other issue. How could Dar ever know?
Much like with Carrie, Dar got him back in a miracle recovery. It's not like Carrie's the only one who experienced a miracle with Quinn's recovery.
Yes. And then the other Dar layer on this is people are trying to decide. Dar's been outplayed. I mean, if you believe the conversation on the phone, he was like, you take orders from me to Belli. Has he been outplayed? Has Dar been outplayed?
Yes.
And then what will Dar do in the middle of being outplayed? Will he, I mean, Dar is a master manipulator, right? Like, he can make it all work for his benefit. So at the moment, he's right in the middle of a evil conspiracy around O'Keefe and Onyx and whoever's funding that operation, which can't be O'Keefe, by the way. Like, there's no way this man makes enough money. No one on even talk radio makes enough money to fund this kind of thing. So it's some Mossad, like, South Korea, Iran, God knows what.
North Korea, sorry.
South Korea
is pretty much
wrong,
okay.
North Korea, sorry! Oh my God! And I majored in politics, sorry. But anyway, that's the other question, is that, like, will he become, and I actually think that's what's most interesting about Dar, is that I think he might, I think all of this, like, what do you call it, Sarah, mustache tweaking or
twirling.
Mustache twirling. That's like a famous phrase. That's like a well-known phrase.
I know. It feels a little overplayed to me. Like, it feels like at the end of the day, we might find a Dar that was being outplayed within the conspiracy and might reveal it. Just saying.
Well, there have been a lot of discussions around, like, what this episode does set up for the last three episodes. And I want to kind of finish by talking about that, unless there was more that you guys had to say about Dar and Quinn and everything, but I thought we kind of reached a nice...
Oh, just Max. Just a quick deep dive on Max.
We could talk about Max. I have nothing to say except I love him, and he's too pure for this show.
Guys, right now I am in the whole Max sock puppets room thing, and I'm pretty sure somebody's on AO3.
What? I'm confused.
You know how the social media sites, everybody's on different sites. You see Tumblr, you see Facebook, you see... I think someone's on AO3.
I don't even understand what you're talking about.
AO3. Oh,
I know AO3. I freaking publish on AO3, but I don't understand. What does that have to do with Max?
Well, because Max went into Onyx and he went through the firewall with all the sock puppets, the and then everybody's on social media.
One of the dudes
looks like he's on AO3.
Oh my god!
Like one of the websites that one of the people is on looks like AO3.
Send me the pic.
I will.
We'll put it on the blog. I love it.
That would be really funny.
Because who rants and raves about spy plotting on AO3? Absolutely no one. But that's okay.
I mean, I can't tell. It's like it might be too many words, but it's the same, like, format.
It's like red and white. Yeah.
It's the red banner.
For anyone who doesn't understand...
The entire time we've been talking, like, I had already gotten to this point in the episode, and I looked up, and I've been trying to rewind to it. And I just paused it. I'll send it to you as soon as we get off the call.
Okay.
Max.
Sweet Max.
Max. I love
heroin.
Max.
Heroin. I'm not buying the heroin. I just it's refuse.
Meth. It was meth.
Oh, meth.
Me either. I really Which do is even think less, that was a deliberate. Like,
that's even harder to buy. Like, heroin. I mean, just like Max doing like hard drugs is like, that's not true.
I'm not buying it.
I genuinely believe that Eminem was a reference to, you misquoted me a little bit yesterday, Cynthia. Sorry. So I was too tired to deal with
it. I'm sure I did.
So Eminem in medical parlance is a monthly meeting that doctors and teaching hospitals have. It's called Morbidity and Mortality. And basically it's a meeting where doctors get to say, all right, well, this is what happened in this case, and these are the things we could have done differently, and they take responsibility for the things they did wrong that may have led to a poor outcome for a patient. So I know that
it was supposed to be masturbation and meth.
Meth. I know that Max quickly cleared that up, but I feel like the Eminem reference was very much... Like, when he said that and he paused and, like, there was a whole moment when it was just Eminem. That's what it felt like to me. And it's not just it's not, like, an unknown term or anything. Atul Gawande posts in The New Yorker about it. So, I really think that's what they were doing. I think that was the reference. And especially because, to some extent, Max's actions... Kind of, sort of, I mean, not as much as Carrie's, but he could have done things differently that would have led to Farrah being okay. And that's what that felt like. But I'm probably the only nerd that picked that up.
No, I think that's a really interesting insight.
I think it's cool.
And I buy that Max is kind of weird and socially awkward, and maybe that's just what he referred to that as, and it's really hard to imagine that he like did meth for an entire year, because he literally looks exactly the same. I can't imagine that like a year of doing meth would not have some kind of like a
physical... It's now been 3 years.
No, in the year it's 2016, and that
I know, but Farrah died 2.5 years before season 5.
I guess that's true.
So
I guess she died in 2014. That's true.
Yeah.
Anyways.
Can we just take a moment? Ashley, you've just corrected Sarah on timeline canon.
I did.
I'm All right. Pat myself We're moving on. Right We're moving on. So what this episode sets up for the last 3 episodes of the season. The first is what's going on with Belly, and is Dar in control or not? Second
no, he's
is
not.
There's this
he's not.
Okay. I'll just rattle down the list of questions and you guys can say what you think. Second is Carrie is like, what's up with this Saul Carrie deposition? This is how we're gonna bring down Dar, except Saul's gonna get a pardon down the line. Like, that was weird. I very rarely have this like feeling when I'm watching the show of like, we missed something important, like something crucial was left out. But they cut from the scene of Carrie in the hotel room with Keen and Rob and the Solicitor General, where she's protesting pretty strongly against Saul not being there and them talking about kind of throwing him under the bus in order to get Dar. She's protesting pretty strongly, like, I really think that he needs to be here, like, this isn't okay. And then they cut to the scene in the park where she's just like, so here's what's gonna happen. And he's like, what the fuck? And she's like, she promised a pardon, like, it'll all be cool. Like, they're, like, we missed something really important there that I think will come back to be relevant.
Well, what's particularly interesting about that is the fact that in the very beginning, when Kina's asking for information on Dara Dahl, Carrie says, well, I signed an NDA and she promised her a pardon. And that was back in, what, episode 2, 3?
Yeah, that was a few episodes ago where they wanted
dirt on him. And that wasn't sufficient for her.
And by the way, like, it's kind of weird to me because at the time I was like, oh, she's going to tell him about, like, the Haqqani stuff, right?
Because I thought that, so, too.
I thought that that's so where they were going because that implicated Saul as well because she knew that Saul was a beneficiary of that deal. But this was interesting that they went in this direction instead. And if it was all for the line of Saul being like, well, coming from someone who fucked a guy in a suicide vest, that means a lot. That line was so, like, I can't even believe that happened. It was like my soul left my body sort of a moment.
Your anti-Saul left your body.
I mean, yeah, this is coming from someone who, like, does not like him. I do not like Saul, but I, like, yelped and cheered because it was just such, oh my God, it was such a great line. It was, like, so deliciously petty. Oh, it was so great.
So there's a broader interpretation of this, you guys, and we might be taking this as normal, but the reason that Carrie can be deposed on this issue is because she was not in the CIA. So CIA operatives, I guess, have super secrecy stuff that they're protected from. But one of the reasons she can be deposed on what happened in Berlin is because she was not in the CIA.
So you're saying that the reason that they chose this instead of the season 4 thing was because technically in season 4, she was still in the CIA when all that happened?
Yeah, like, all I know is what I read from the girls who Google up a storm on LiveJournal, and apparently that's, like, apparently it would be a much harder thing to get a CIA operative. You can depose anyone, right, depending on the level of government and court inquisition or congressional stuff going on, but it's a harder thing to get someone like Saul deposed than it is to get a layperson deposed. So,
but why would it be harder to get, why would it be harder to depose Carrie on season 4's information than season 5?
In season four, she was a CIA operative.
I know, but this is after, and they made the whole point.
No, the distinction is that. You could make the case of, I'm sorry, I can't say that at the time I was employed by the CIA, blah, 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 where she can't make that same statement if she's deposed about the season 5 stuff.
They made this whole thing at the end of season, or at the beginning of season 4, when Quinn is in his mandated therapy session saying, well, you might want to talk about this someday.
Right, but doesn't he say right after that? Yeah, doesn't he say right after that?
I agree to, but that doesn't mean anything.
The legality of all of this is not that interesting to me. I think it's just really one of the things I actually really appreciate about this season is how much they continue to call back to previous seasons and things that happened, and I love the feeling of being rewarded as a viewer for watching the show for so many years and remembering all of these events that happened. Like, I don't always feel like the writers are generally interested in sort of going down that route where they kind of pull on threads from past seasons, but they did it this episode with Afarah stuff, with
I think they want to do it. I think they want to do it, and they just, it's hard to do on this show.
They've done a really good job of it this season. Like, it's been really awesome to watch all these different threads kind of be pulled up into, like, the entire plot of the season is really, I think it's impressive, actually.
That is impressive. And I think, I don't know, you are the parallel queen and star, et cetera, but maybe this is just the first year that I'm really thinking about it, but I feel like they've been way more successful with their parallels and callbacks this year than they have in previous seasons.
Well, I think a part of it is they just have more material to draw from. Like, imagine if you're thinking, like, what's the plot of season six going to be? And they have basically five seasons worth of material to kind of pull from because, I mean, for the characters, it's their lives. It's not like it's these separate seasons that exist independently of each other. Like, all these events, like, did happen. And I like the, I mean, what's kind of weird is that in some respects, at the very least, the first two seasons of the show feel like there are no consequences for anybody's actions. Like, it kind of feels like that way sometimes. Like, things that you would have expected to be, like, huge things. Like, for example, Brody killing the vice president and Carrie, like, being complicit. And, like, that happened. Like, I thought that there was going to be, like, a huge storyline in season three, and it was never brought up again. And beginning in season three, and especially in from season four onward, they began to play with this idea of the fact that, like, the actions that these characters take, sometimes immorally, like, have real consequences. And they have done, like, a really good job this season of showing that the seasons of the show don't exist in a vacuum, and that, like, these characters have lives, and, like, these things actually happened to them and they matter.
I think part of it, and this might just be the way that I think about things in general in life, is the fact that we have had three seasons with Brody and now we're closing out our third season without him.
Right.
And I think hitting that sort of midpoint is valuable. I think that is something that they actually thought about.
That's interesting.
And are bringing it up because, like, now we've had half the series with him, and we're in just a few days, in a few weeks, we're going to be half a series without him. And as soon as 6/12 airs, we'll have spent less time with him than we've spent without him. And yet he is still such a specter over this show.
But I think that's so interesting. Like, I kind of love that. I love that the show has a really rich history to it. And I love that you never know whether or not something that happens this week or last week or whenever, like, might come back in the future to be actually really relevant and important. And I think it makes you watch the show in a different way, because that's not like some kind of procedural or whatever, where it's like every single episode just kind of exists and, you know, it's just like the same story every week. Like, I like the fact that they bring up things from the past that maybe you didn't ever think they would bring up again, and they become really important. And I think it rewards, like, close viewership, and I appreciate that about a television series.
Cricket.